G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 232nd, in which we'll be talking about Walter Raleigh, Eleanor Butler, and Jim's going to do a bit of religion. Let's get on with it. Just a little sampler there of Oh Clap Your Hands by Orlando Gibbons, which he would have written about where we are in the podcast. Orlando Gibbons was rather clever. Obviously, he wrote churchy music. Everybody writes churchy music. But he could also write a galliard, so we could dance to it at the disco. And that bit of music there was written for waits. Now, waits is an occupation. And like a lot of occupations, it gives its name to some of our modern surnames. So, as in Tom Waits, the singer, or Rick Wakeman, the marvellous musician. Waits and Wakeman are derivatives of this Waits guys. So, it kicked off as the kind of Night's Watch. And over time, the Night's Watch would be given an instrument to learn, and they'd have to play it here and there during the night to prove that they were on duty. This then evolved into a group of guys who could play music. And where we are in space-time, pretty much every town and city has got waits. And part of their job is to play a little lullaby. At dusk, they wander around, play a little lullaby. And then again at dawn to wake you up. And what an excellent use of taxpayers' money is that, my dear listener. Wake up in the morning to some nice music, and then just before you're ready to go to sleep, you get more brilliant stuff. Now, last week, we tidied up Bess of Hardwick, who died, one of the richest and most powerful people in England. But was she happy? I can't say it myself. It wasn't a happy family, which can be common with people who start with very little and make a fortune. Their kiddies grow up completely different to the parent. Kiddies grow up in a family that's got lots of money, so the kiddies expect stuff, while their parents expect the kiddies to not spend on fun, but make more money. Yeah, big mobs of money may not lead you along the happiness path, but at least you're well fed in your misery, I guess. Now, we're all wondering, though, whether Arbella will finally crack that living happily ever after elusive thing, the holy grail of life. Unlikely, but we will get back to it in the fullness of time. We have the outline of what's been going on with Walter Raleigh, but let's colour it in. Foolishly, he stayed out of the fawning over King Jim VI, so was off to a terrible start when Jim VI became Jim I and VI. Walter did return to London to march in Betty's funeral parade, but while he was doing that, some guy looking for a nice toy from Jim I and VI scored Raleigh's job as Captain of the Guard. And there you go. Walter did the right thing, cost him his job. As the Jews might say, no good deed goes unpunished. Walter will go in to see King Jim 1 and 6. Jim will be clear that he's got no use for Walter. Walter hadn't helped by saying, hey Jim, we should go and build up the Spanish, where Jim had decided he wanted peace. Jim also had that old Devereux fan club whispering in Jim's ear that Walter was a turd, and that Walter had odd ideas on religion. Eh, he does have odd ideas, I guess. Jim does not want people having any ideas on religion. Just do the Anglican stuff. It's a great religion for a king. The two guys were pretty opposite in any case. Fucking crow, now I'm going to have to say that again. I'll say it again. The two guys were pretty opposite in any case. Walter saw the world as a wonderful place full of brilliant stuff, and lots of it is stuff we don't even know about right now. Jim sees the world as a dark, scary place with the devil lurking all over the place just waiting to do bad shit. Walter was a big old manly man, hero material. Jim was a bit of a girly man who couldn't even walk properly. Robert Cecil could see where all this was headed, so he tossed Raleigh's reputation under the number 9 bus from Whitehall. That will get us to the byplot and the main plot, with Walter named as a conspirator in the main plot, which was to replace Jim 1 and 6 with Arbella Stewart. Here's what allegedly was planned. It's only allegedly. The main guy, Lord Cobham, was to get 600,000 crowns from the Austrian ambassador to finance the thing. It's a bit hard to sneak in 600,000 crowns, so the cash would go to Walter in Jersey. Now, I say allegedly again because it looks totally stupid and not doable, that crap. By the time we get to trial, Walter's role has been ramped up to instigator, with Lord Cobham as his dim-witted tool. Of course, there's no evidence against our mastermind, Walter Raleigh. He's a mastermind and won't be leaving anything like evidence. Walter is up against Sir Edward Coke. Tricky? Well, not really. This is Walter. Sir Edward, though, will cock up by saying he'll prove Walter that is the most notorious traitor that ever came to the bar. Yeah, that's a bit over the top. It sounds like King Donald. And the charge is actually just about an alleged conversation with the Austrian ambassador and not king-killing stuff to overthrow the government stuff. None of that is in the charges because the state had nothing. They had bugger all to charge him with. Usual stuff then. No legal counsel for Walter. No cross-examination of the state's one and only witness, Lord Cobham. And Cobham won't even be brought in. The state has fuck all. Walter will point out that both the law and the big book of magic says he's got the right to question his accuser, Cobham. Nah, say our justices. Check precedent, mate. We can do what the fuck we want in a treason trial. Walter will say over and over, look, if you just bring Cobham in to make his accusation here in the court, then I'll roll over and say I'm guilty, but you guys are full of shit. Yes, over and over he'll say that. Lord Chief Justice will say we can't let Cobham speak because this is a huge conspiracy with very many tentacles. Sure, says Walter. Tell me about just one of those many fucking tentacles. Walter also demanded the release of one of his guys who's been in the slammer answering questions for 18 weeks. Walter says you guys threatened him with the rack, and that's illegal. Keeper the rack will say we told him he deserved the rack, but we didn't threaten him with him. Walter will say, mate, look, do you actually get what a fucking threat is? Okay, says Walter, let me get this right. You've got no evidence. You say you had one witness only when you need two for a treason trial, and so you've got a big fat zero case. Oh, say the prosecution. See, he's so cunning, he's a mastermind. So cunning, I only told Cobham about his treason so there wouldn't be two witnesses. Well, you've got the top lawyers in there and they don't like being shown they're wrong. They can try insults now. Raleigh is the spider from hell. Then just say the same stuff they've said before, over and over. If you say it often enough, people might start to believe you. It's so bad that Robert Cecil will stop Sir Edward Coke to let Walter get a word in. We got records of this. Here Mr. Attorney sat down in a chaise and would speak no more until the commissioners urged and entreated him. After much ado, he went out and made a long repetition of all the evidence for the direction of the jury, and at the repeating of some things, Sir Walter Raleigh interrupted him and said he did him wrong. Attorney, thou art the most vile and execrable traitor that ever lived. Raleigh, you speak indiscreetly, barbarously and uncivilly. Attorney, I want words sufficient to express your viperous treason. Raleigh, I think you want words indeed, for you have spoken one thing half a dozen times. Attorney, thou art an odious fellow. Thy name is hateful to all the realm of England for thy pride. Oh, dear. All righty, 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 says Cake. Here's a letter from Cobham saying you agreed to accept £1,500 a year to promote peace between England and Spain. Oh, hang on. That's what Jim wanted, wasn't it? We might be losing touch with reality here, my dear listener. Oh, I see, says Walter. Firstly, that's bullshit. And secondly, if we're finally introducing evidence, then take this letter from Cobham, which says, I know no treason by you. The court is abuzz. Sensational. Okay, says Coke. I can see that it's from Cobham all right, but this is just more of your cunning mastermind. The jury will retire to consider its verdict, and just before you go, lads, don't forget the correct answer is guilty. 15 minutes later, guilty. And so you see, my dear listener, you do not need torture when this sort of shit fuckery goes down. Walter was a smash hit at the trial. He outdid the prosecution bigly. Not that it mattered. Here's the writings of one guy to sum it up for us. At the start of the trial, I was so lit with common hatred that I would have gone 100 miles to have seen Raleigh hanged. After Raleigh spoke, I would have gone 1,000 to save his life. Never was a man so hated and so popular in such a short time. Time for the judge to pass sentence. He will admit that someone like Walter has fallen from such dizzy heights right into the dunny. It goes on and, look, it just makes me sick. It's awful. Tossing in the religion stuff again, and worst of all is that now Walter has been found guilty, he won't confess like a gentleman should. Make us all look good. That's what we want. Tell us we were right. So, Walter, my lad, you've been a bad, bad boy, and it'll be hung, drawn and quartered for you. Cobham was already down to go with the by-plotters to their execution, so their execution date will be brought forward. Cobham will now change his tune. It was just that I was a bit friendly with Arbella, and then my brother George was looking to be a bit more than friendly with Arbella. It was all just good fun, bit of courtly love, and the main plot is just something I was playing with in my head. There's nothing real about it. Okay, so we should be asking why implicate Walter Raleigh, but nobody wants to ask that question. So Cobham, being down to go to the gallows with the byplotters, will ask for pardon and get it. Off to the summer with you. Cobham's brother George won't be getting a pardon. Once we get his head off, the executioner will yell out the usual God save the king or behold the head of the traitor, whatever, and he'll get silence. The mob are not happy. That will worry King Jim 1 and 6. Is the public against him? Has he miscalculated? Send in the Bishop of Winchester to get that much-wanted confession from Walter. No ways is Walter. I get it. I'll be getting a tortured death, so bring it on, but I'm not fucking guilty. Execution day rolls round, but nobody's coming for Walter or Cobham. Jim has read the crowd. Now, Walter isn't locked up tight. He gets to walk around the tower walls every day, where an ever-increasing mob goes to cheer at him. He's the last of the good old Gloriana days when we were belting the Spanish. Not like now, where we have this turd Scotty King. It won't be long before Walter is banned from his daily walk along the walls. Now, the next we hear about Walter is a complaint from the top dog of the tower, the Keeper of the Rack. Yeah, that's what we call the top guy now, the Keeper of the Rack. It's a complaint to Robert Cecil. Walter has taken over his chook house. Walter is using the chook house as a laboratory for his experiments. Plus, Walter is being rude to the Keeper of the Rack. Tough shit is the reply. Walter's got his privileges. We still have a pass system which says how many visitors a prisoner can have based on their social status. As a knight, Walter can have his missus and kitty come to stay overnight for a sleepover. Walter will have a very special visitor, Anne of Denmark, our queen. Anne had some medical problem which the doctors had given up on, so she thought, I'll give Walter a rally a try. Whatever Walter was cooking up in the chook house did the trick. His fame at court and in Europe will rise. Anne will lobby for Walter's release, but she doesn't get on that well with King Jim, so it'll be a no. She will get Robert Cecil to interview Cobham to go over his story again. So what Cecil will find out was that in his original confession, Cobham had confessed with the Keeper of the Rack doing the secretarial work, writing stuff down. The Keeper of the Rack then decided he'd just add the stuff about Walter. So Cecil will go in and interview Cobham again, but whatever he said was top secret, we don't know. Walter will claim that Cobham had definitely recanted and so was popped into a cell for a bit so he could change his mind, thanks. Walter overall will keep busy with his writing, including a book, The History of the World. But really it's his work in the chook house that is rather brilliant. Walter will become the most famous producer of medicines in England. His work is paving the way for chemists, and he's becoming one of the most important intellectuals of the English Renaissance. Now, that wasn't a brand new hobby for Walter. About 20 years earlier, he had sent Bess of Hardwick a concoction of pearl and coral to fix up something or other. Now, pearl is definitely something that is in our medicine chest, and right now, our science types are examining coral as a potential wonder drug. Walter was also into reading about toxicology, living in harmony with nature, crystal healings, and the nature of experience with proper scientific inquiry. Mulder's also got a buddy in the tower, Henry Percy, the Wizard Earl. Yeah, he's in the summer because of his relative Tom Percy, the gunpowder plotter. The Wizard Earl just loves scientific experiments. Some of Walter's recipes for medicines will keep on going in the US into the 20th century. Now, back then, Queen Anne was taking a general tonic called a Great Cordial daily. Think of it as like a big old multivitamin pill. Walter's style of thinking is that a harmonious relationship with nature and the idea of unseen forces being at play in the world will disappear in the Enlightenment and be replaced with the idea that we are humans and so need to control nature. Yeah, and look where that's got us. But that's Walter updated for us, so I think we want to check in on Will, but just for a tick.
You have too much respect upon the world. They lose it that do buy it with much care.
I hold the world, but as the world, Gratian. A stage where every man must play his part. And mine a sad one.
You see, our Merchant of Venice, Antonio, there, telling us that we all play our part, and at the moment, his part is to play a sad person who's worried about where the fuck his ships have got to. And this is where we left Will. He was writing this play, The Merchant of Venice. It's another copy of an Italian play, The Dunce. Plot goes like this. Merchant needs cash and Shylock the Jew will provide that cash. Security for the loan is a pound of the merchant's flesh. Merchant will default on the loan because his merchant ships have disappeared. So Shylock wants his pound of flesh. The merchant's good mate will offer to pay twice the amount of the loan, but Shylock doesn't want that. He wants revenge on Christians because his daughter had eloped with a Christian, taking a lot of his cash with her. Off we go to court to litigate the matter. In comes an intelligent woman, disguised as an Anne judge. Of course she's disguised. Women can't be judges. Everybody knows that. The upshot is that we will be pointing out to the Jew that his act was immoral and ask him to show kindness and forgiveness. And yeah, look, it was immoral, but our Jew will hold up a mirror to the Christians, pointing out their own immorality. Clever girly judge will then give us the answer. Shylock can legally take his pound of flesh, but the contract does not stipulate blood. And it is totally specific that the amount of flesh to be taken is a pound. Not a bit more, not a bit less. Obviously, Shylock can't take a pound of flesh without getting some blood, and it would be rather tricky to take an exact pound anyway. Oh, fuck it, says Shylock. I didn't think of that. Okay, I'll just take that double payment that your mate offered. Girly judge will say, no way, buddy. Okay, says Shylock, just pay me the principal back. Not a chance, mate. You've already rejected those offers in this very court, so nothing for you. And if you think that's bad, then let me tell you another thing. You're a Jew, therefore a non-citizen, who has threatened the life of our merchant. So half your goods will be going to the government and the other half to our merchant. And I suggest you now start begging for your own life, and if you get that, then start begging the government for half your property, but the other half will absolutely be going to that merchant. The Duke will pardon Shylock if he will convert to the Baby Jesus Club. Or he can take the death penalty. Your pick, Shylock. So Shylock will agree to convert. Off we go to live happily ever after, and hey, as the grand finale, those missing ships come in. Well, maybe Shylock didn't live happily ever after, but he's a Jew. Who cares about Jews? Nobody cares about Jews. But for Shakespeare and his English audience, it's definitely a happy ending for Shylock, because now he's a Christian, so he will surely get into heaven. And everybody then did get to live happily ever after, although Shylock's got to wait till he dies to be happy ever after. Let's then just check in on English Jews. There still aren't any. Ted I gave them the boot in 1290, so they're kind of mythical things for our English. We still do the blood libel speechifying. In a few years' time, the Dean of St. Paul's will give a sermon on that very subject. The blood libel is where we say the Jews drink the blood of Christian babies. Now, in Venice, where this play was set, Jews had to wear a red hat and lived in ghettos. We're not liking this mob. As for morality, well, it looks a bit like Shylock represents the old magic book, where God can go totally fucking nuts and do all sorts of awful shit. while the Christians represent the new magic book where it's all peas, love and lentils. What Shakespeare has done, though, is provide a nice bit of anti-Jew propaganda. The Nazis will actually broadcast this play and make Shylock their role model for a Jew. But there you go. This is how Jews will be portrayed in literature for years and years. This whole thing, though, depends on you, my dear listener, as the audience member. You can have empathy for Shylock. Like, that whole court case was totally fucking dodgy. Some woman comes in dressed as a man and just says, "Hey, everybody, I'm a judge." If Shylock or anyone else had asked for some credentials, then we'd have a different situation. A bunch of characters will accuse Shylock of dishonesty when, during the play, we've seen that these guys were also dishonest. Shakespeare also gave Shylock the best lines in the play and one of the finest speeches I think Shakespeare's ever written. Shylock was asked, "What use is a pound of flesh to you?" So I think we'll let Shylock tell you himself through Al Pacino.
"I'm sure if you forfeit, you will not take his flesh. What's that good for?"
"To bait fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me. 500,000 laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies, and what's his reason? I am a Jew! Hath that a Jew eyes? Hath that a Jew hands? Organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge? If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferings be? By Christian example. Why revenge? The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will bet the instruction."
Yeah, marvellous stuff, and Shylock might have just gone from a hated villain to just some human who's looking for perhaps a tiny bit of equality. Let's pop out of the rabbit hole that was a play about the law and look at the law. Things have been happening, so let's recap on law, which is the foundation of our modern society. Our Anglos and Saxons brought their own laws to England, the word guild. Instead of an eye for an eye, it's more like cash for an eye. The rest of Europe was still using a form of the old Roman laws back to the Empire days. 1066, in comes Bill the Bastard, who wanted the optics to be more like this was a legal takeover rather than an invasion. So he didn't fiddle too much with the laws of Ted the Confessor, but he did make a start. That gave us common law, which was administered by the king to go with canon law, administered by the churchy types. Common law is pretty much based on precedent and not legislation. It's not written down. Not the greatest system, and while it's the churchy types looking after canon law, they're also the guys who do the common law work. They're the guys who can read and write, and at this stage we haven't invented lawyers. It's a good start though, and we're actually starting to keep records. Anglo-Saxon law wasn't just tossed out. They'd built up a pretty decent system and had some good stuff in it, like juries. So what we got was a combination of Anglo-Saxon and Roman light put in. A new set of rules based on local conditions will start to emerge. The big deal, of course, is land, as we know. The king's got it all, and then other people are tenants. So you get three different tenancies. Fee simple, which says you can leave your land to whoever you like when you die. Fee tail, which says only your descendants can inherit it. and life estates, and when you die, land goes straight back to the king. Local lords administered this stuff, but our Norman kings brought in the king's court, which started to standardise the rules of the court. The king's court was a bit like the old Witenagemot. Well, I think I've said it right for once. But it had judicial powers as well as being the king's counsel. Most of the business, of course, was taken up with land cases, and so the rules were expanded to give us a clearer picture of what could or couldn't happen. The king's court, the curia regis, would have great councils where we get guys from all over England, but also a smaller court in kind of continuous session. This is where the whole court idea comes from. It's a legal court in session wherever the king happens to be. These are the king's officers of state, like your chancellor and so on, plus any nobles who just happen to be in town at the time. The smaller court, of course, travels with the king when he's out and about. It was Henry I who started some real changes, then Henry II ramped it up. From that, we started to get judges who were guys best placed to advise the king. Henry II brought in the idea of travelling judges to go around investigating local practices. Hey, sheriff, show me your accounts and so on. It's a bit like tax inspectors who also do judicial work. Scary fuckers for the mob out in the country, and we have things going on like local lords getting out of town so they don't have to face these guys. That then led to Henry giving up the travel idea, so he picked 5 guys to be the court of the King's Bench. Now that'll be based in London, and they'll work together to develop laws, plus they will go on a circuit, that is, travelling, taking the laws with them. The finance stuff will be split off to a new mob called the Exchequer, so we split the law and money. Members of the Exchequer are known as justices or justicars. Law broke right down under Wicked King John, so the barons will insert a clause into Magna Carta to say the King's Bench must be stationary. It's got to stay in one place. The King's Court, though, will continue to travel with him for about another 100 years. Then it'll start to split off from the Crown and will end up as its own institution. But we're getting the start of legislation. We've got 3 bodies, then. The Exchequer, the Common Pleas, and the King's Bench, who will compete with each other to get cases, because they want the lovely legal fees. Common law, which had been mainly about land, doesn't have anything to do with civil cases. These are handled by the Crown in the form of a writ, which may, say, appear in the Royal Court or some lesser local court, depending on the case. Then, under John's son Henry III, we got Parliament. Yeah, kicking and screaming for Henry III. 10-1 brought in the idea of a select group to advise the Curia Regis, which was the Secret Council. Later changed to the Privy Council, and in our modern society, it's the Cabinet in your House of Representatives. Allegedly, these guys are the best and brightest of your country. Yeah, I say allegedly. We're now getting a split between a general law, or a set of written rules, and common law, which reflects a local area, and its customs, which is founded on, we hope, reason. Ted will also revolutionise law. That's why he's Super Ted. Trial by jury becomes compulsory. Local jurisdiction becomes limited. Appeals to the circuit court become easy. It'll actually take until 1920 for the feudal land system to totally go and all land becomes fee simple. But strictly speaking, Betty Too could still do stuff with land. Yeah. We get to Dick II, and our slowly introduced laws have become established but are showing problems. You might have an informal contract, and if something goes pear-shaped, you might be stuffed. That is an injustice, and all you can do is petition the king, asking him to do as morality and good conscience requires. The king may say, "What the fuck do I know?" So now we get the highest admin official, the chancellor, a senior churchy types to do these sort of things. He's the guy with the morality. We can now have a busy chancellor who will recognise some commonality with cases. Fraud, breach of promise, trying to get paid twice type stuff. We can then handle those cases the same way each time. 1529, in comes Sir St. Tom More as chancellor, the first non-churchy type in the role. Sir St. Tom will develop rules and start publishing cases with their results, and unlike earlier chancellors, Sir St. Tom will find himself bound to precedent, much like common law. During Sir St. Thomas' life, Henry will give the Pope the boot and become head of the church in England, meaning that the crown is now the top of civil and canon law. Getting close to where we are, so bring on Sir Edward Coke. Now, Parliament had failed to bring legislation to deal with contracts. The idea is if that you want to sue somebody for failure of contract, then you have to first prove it's a case of fraud. Yeah, I know, messy, isn't it? John Slade will bring a case against Humphrey Morley, and it's the same old thing. Chief Justice of the King's Bench will pick this one and take it from the Court of Common Pleas into the King's Bench, with Slade represented by Coke and Morley represented by Francis Bacon. Two brainiacs going head to head, and Coke will smartly not attack Bacon's arguments. Instead, he's going to say, look, the law isn't right. An agreement implies that payment will be made. It's nothing to do with fraud. 5 years later, yeah, 5 years, and the Chief Justice will agree with Coke. Now, this is a rare case where the judiciary is overriding legislation, so our parliamentarians need to fix the legislation. It's what happened a couple of years ago in Australia when the Catholic Church said they couldn't be sued because they didn't legally exist. Correct. So our parliamentarians changed legislation, and now you can sue them. Now that and several other high-profile cases will see Coke elected to Parliament and then become Solicitor General, then Speaker of the House, and finally Chief Justice. The point is that Shakespeare... Oh, I've got back to Shakespeare's play at last. It was rather timely, with the English not being that happy about the law, which led to guys like Coke and Bacon looking for systemic reforms. And there's some big stuff going to come up shortly for us in that reform. Now, law students watching The Merchant of Venice would recognise that it represents the worst of statute law. If that had happened in our English law courts, then The Merchant would have been rather dead, with Shylock having his pound of flesh. Well, not really, because English law didn't allow you to put your life at risk in a contract. But after the decision of Slade versus Morley, Shylock wouldn't stand a chance in an English court. Now, this has led me to a time where I can toss in a little tale, just because I can. It's about Shakespeare, and I like it, so let's toss it in. There was this star actor, Richard Burbage, and he had lots of groupies. Right now, he's famous for playing Richard III. He will have a chat to a lady who is besotted with him, and Burbage will arrange a tryst. Now, that's an olden days term for a good banging. Yeah, a damn good rogering. Shakespeare overheard what had gone on, so Shakespeare got to her first. So he's having a lovely time with this lady when in comes a message for the lady saying, Richard III is here. Shakespeare sent back a message saying, tell him William the Conqueror came here first. Marvellous stuff, Will. Be an island. Last week we tidied up the self-made super wealthy woman Bess of Hardwick, who started out with fart all and ended up the wealthiest woman in England. So perhaps we should tidy up Eleanor Butler, who married into a heap of money, but it was soon gone because of the English forcing a rebellion with the plan to take all the lovely Desmond lands. This means we'll be popping into the future for a bit, but I'm all over the place with the timeline at the moment, aren't I? So, let's keep going. The Hugh O'Neill rebellion is over, so Eleanor and new husband, Donogh O'Connor Sligo, should be back to being super rich. Wrong. Not at all. Donogh has done okay in the getting of the English to give him lots of his lands back, but the lands and buildings have been just devastated by the war. Donogh and Eleanor are living in one of the least wrecked buildings at the moment, but it had been smashed up and burned. It's not great. And it's worse, of course. Part of the deal is that Donogh has to fix everything up. And, of course, his tenants' lands and houses were likewise destroyed, so there's not much cash coming in. And Eleanor is back to, really, living in poverty. It can't get worse, you say. No. No, you don't. You know it's going to be worse. Rapacious English speculators are bringing in the bloody lawyers to try and prove that they own bits of his lands. Even worse, some of those English are taking his rents, saying, yeah, no, they're my rents. Donnet will spend the rest of his life fighting court cases. Eleanor and her unmarried daughters were at least getting that pension from England, so there is that, except it's not being paid. 1603, and she with those daughters are off to London to hang out in court to try and get a hearing. They'll be there for 9 months, and we already know it's very expensive hanging out at court. She's also trying to get some of the original Desmond lands back. The misery of our estate is such that we are ashamed to make it manifest to the world. Now, the women are familiar faces at the court by now, but without cash to grease up wheels, it's hard to get a hearing. And they're staying in the unsavoury quarters of London, the cheap bit, skipping meals to try and keep up the all-important appearance. Finally, in 1605, Robert Cecil will come through, getting a pension and arrears paid. Eleanor will be back in for a further payment, 1 year's advance, which she needs to just pay off her debts in London. And Robert Cecil will actually agree to it. It looks like this was just to get her out of his bloody hair. She had said that if he didn't pay that advance, she'd have to stay longer to pay off her debts. And I think Robert Cecil's over. 66-year-old Eleanor can return to Ireland and Donno. What you been up to, Donno? Oh, I've been going to court. It's no fun. He's facing a situation where the English government do not want any Irish getting big estates. If they get a big estate and get them going well, then they can afford to rebel. On top of that, the individual English are just rapacious in their efforts to get his stuff. 1609, and Eleanor will write to Cecil to let him know Donno is dead. The tedious in withstanding the said causes did so weary and wear him out that in the end the grief finished his life. Now it seems totally clear that Eleanor was very sad that he was dead. When every back was turned to her, it was Donno who took her in and tried to give her a lifestyle suitable to a countess. She'll write his epitaph personally. Is your hand the martial hand that shone in war, and yours the gentle one that shone in peace turned to ashes? I, who with moistened cheeks stretch forth my arms in redoubled lamentation, will ever be mindful of your death. And it also certainly seems that Donnet was in love with Eleanor when we read his will. 13 castles, 100 manors, 10 gardens, 4,000 acres of land, 1,000 acres of pasture, 1,000 acres of wood, 1,000 acres of moor, and 3,000 acres of heath. Yeah, and sadly, all smashed up and devastated and subject to lots of legal battles. Dear me. Eleanor is a widow for the second time, and like Gilbert and Mary Talbot, she has a heap of assets but no cash, and the revenue-raising power of her estates is pretty much nothing. It takes time to rebuild after a devastating war. Worse for Eleanor because her estates need cash put into them before they'll eventually start paying again, and she just doesn't have cash. Eleanor will swing back into action on what she can do, which is matchmaking. Donno's main heir was his young brother, so Eleanor will marry off a daughter to this guy. That's great. It'll help, except that young brother will die 2 years later. Fuck it. Back into action, and Eleanor will now get that daughter married to one of the English administrators. Nice work there. We've got a man on the inside. Eleanor's youngest daughter will marry an heir to a Kerry estate. Okay, Eleanor can enjoy a nice retirement. Not because Donno's younger brother and heir to his estate has died, so that has now passed on to Donno's son from a previous marriage. He's a minor, so his wardship will be granted to the marvellously named Sir Faithful Fortescue. What a name. Sir Faithful will now try to get Eleanor's lands, saying there were defects in the wording of the conveyance. Eleanor will have to keep on going to the Irish Privy Council to fight for a claim. Fuck, she's 68. These things take time, so eventually in 1613, when the decision's about to be made, 68-year-old Eleanor will send a message saying, I'm fucked. I'm old, I'm dying, and I can't attend. The Privy Council will send out commissioners to investigate. Oh yeah, they say, this is a feeble old sick chook who'll be off to heaven any second now. We recommend you do whatever you can for the poor old love so she can be free of the worry of this unexpected court case. Lord Deputy and the Council will say, oh, sure, little about a few remaining days in style and playing bingo with the other old chooks. She can keep her estates for life. And ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Eleanor Butler, Countess of Desmond, will get an Oscar for Best Actress. She's going to outlive a lot of these buggers. And so this is not quite the final say on Eleanor Butler, who will be back in future episodes for her obituary. Yeah, quite a while in the future. She's going to live to 83. Supernatural, they're singing about an idiot, so it must mean we're back to the star of the show, King Jim of 1 and 6. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm still saying he's intelligent, but he's a total fucking idiot as well. We'd better see what he was up to while I was rabbiting on about the buy plot, the main plot, and the gunpowder plot. King Jim turned up in England, and that made some people happy, and of course, some people not happy. Among the not happy will be ambitious guys who fail to get a job. Among the happy will be the non-Anglican types, the Catholics, who are, well, Catholics, and Puritans, which is kind of what we decided you are if you're not Catholic and not really doing the full Anglican thing. Puritans is a generalisation. That's not a smart idea. In respect to Catholics, Jim will see a division. There are Catholics who are loyal to the king, and so they're okay. And there are Catholics who are loyal to the fat guy in Rome, and no, that's not okay. As long as you're loyal to the king, then go do whatever magic show you like, but if it isn't Anglican, then do it on the quiet. Now, the Catholics were very happy when Jim 1 and 6 almost immediately said he was going to negotiate peace with Spain. Well, not only did he say it, he actually got started. We'll never know what Jim said to who, but we've already seen Tom Percy saying that Jim told him that he'd make Catholic at least legit again. A Jesuit in Scotland had said he could prove that Jim was Catholic with a document written by Jim personally. And the last letter Jim had from the Pope was to inquire if Prince Henry Fred would be brought up Catholic. The English Catholics then were pretty certain that stuff like recusancy fines would be gone. In Ireland, the locals took it as a message to ramp Catholicism up again. Jesuits are going there in droves with lots of lovely relics to show the Irish. As we know, not only will recusancy fines not disappear, they'll ramp up, and the English Catholics are unhappy enough to give us the buy plot, which was fuck, because Catholics who were loyal to Jim and Jesuits who wanted Jim gone couldn't get along. Yeah, of course they couldn't get along. The main plot was about the other unhappy group, guys who didn't get jobs. Their plan was to put Arbella on the big chair and marry her to a European Catholic power player. Stupid fucking idea, given that Arbella was loyal to Jim and she was pretty Protestant. Now, this may also help why Raleigh was stitched up. He'd lost his jobs because perhaps he was very anti-Spain at a time when we have to welcome Spain with open arms. King Jim then will amaze the English by not executing the main plotters. The sentence, though, is suspended, so that's pretty cruel. You're in the tower on the basis, on a whim, Jim could just have you killed one day. 1604, and that peace deal with Spain will be done. For Jim, this is step one in his master plan to unite Europe. He's united Scotland and England, he thinks. Made peace with Spain, he thinks. Now he wants to keep that rolling along. As Jim 6 of Scotland, he'd made plenty of peace treaties around Europe, but that might be more down to it being Scotland and a bit insignificant. So, yeah, you want a peace deal with whoever, Bohemia? Sure, mate. But for Jim, the Spanish treaty was a big ego boost. and can be both a Protestant ruler and a friend of Catholic Spain. Jim, though, had just caught a lucky break, really. Spain was too broke to keep fighting in the lowlands, and their attempts at helping the Irish had failed, so they were in a bit of a box. All the hard yards had been done by Betty. Still, he has revoked the licences of the privateers to go Spanish bashing on the basis that he hadn't personally been at war with Spain, and the Spanish surely liked that. Just while Jim was doing that, a Spanish ambassador had turned up with orders to make a peace deal in England. So, yeah, good timing, but Jim thinks it's his mighty brain that did it all. The deal could have been done immediately, except the Spanish caused delays so the rest of Europe could see it was a hard-fought peace for both sides. It's about the optics. Jim, though, will now become a bit aggro with the lowlanders. He's thinking about doing a Bess of Hardwick and taking possession of towns put up as security for loans. Now, taking towns for another nation is a bit different to taking a land parcel from a single creditor. He's also saying they were fools for revolting against their Spanish masters. Duchies will send in an ambassador, Jim won't see him. To be fair, Jim did make a decent treaty, but for the Spanish it failed in not providing for the Spanish to use England as a launching point so that they could have land available to quickly go back to their war in the lowlands once they've saved up their pocket money. Nor can they ask for cash and hard men from the English Catholics to help them belt up the duchies. Nor would Jim go fully against the lowlanders, just those who are rebelling. Robert Cecil can chip in to get full trading rights. The upshot for the English types is, hey, it's nice to have peace with Spain, but there's plenty in that treaty that they might not like. For Jim, though, Spain's been ticked off his to-do list. Now he wants to think about religion. He's an idiot. How about you and I be King Jim, my dear listener, for a minute? We've put up with those Presbyterian fuckers in Scotland for years, and now we come into marvellous England with its nicely obedient church. We may not be as intelligent as King Jim, but I think we're way smarter. We'll be thinking, like Jim, this is all marvellous. But unlike Jim, we might want to think how this marvellous state of affairs came about, and we would work it out that it was Gloriana, with a brilliant policy of no fucking theological chat. Listen, my churchy types, just don't do the stupid debating over magic. It just causes mystery. That was Betty's policy. Now, Jim has found about a half dozen top churchy types who, like him, are intelligent. They're totally on board with Jim as the head of the church thing, and for the trifecta, they're good at the courtier business, you know, telling Jim he's beautiful and whatever. Jim will totally like these blokes, and he'll want to debate theology with them. You wanker! Let's kick off with his policy on religion. In his first parliament, he'll divide people into three. First are the good people, the Anglicans and loyal Catholics who keep quiet. Next are the not good people, the Catholics, but they're really filthy papists. And last, this big bundle that we've just tossed in, which we call Puritans and Novelists. Novelists are guys who want a bit more reform, and Puritans are, well, yeah, we just don't know. Like, it's a mixed bag. That's the problem with this religion stuff. Every man for his own bloody thing. So Jim's totally missed the point with that last lot. He's lumped a whole lot of different people into one group. Some of these guys might be super moderate. Oh, well. So, a bunch of people that range from guys who just see a tiny bit of detail that they think needs fixing to people who want to bring the government down and put in a theocracy are all in the one bucket. And, of course, one of the Reformation ideas that is still hanging around, you won't believe it, still hanging around, we're arguing about what frock should the magician wear. Oh, it doesn't seem to be a big deal, yet it is. And that leads us to another problem with Jim and his attitude to the non-essentials. If you recall, Jim had written a book for Prince Henry Fred, including that. It's what he sees as the trivia of this religion debate, like what I'm seeing, the frock, who cares? But for churchy types, there's no such thing as non-essentials. The frock is very important. Back to you and I, perhaps thinking differently to Jim, we would, having found out that this happiness with the church was down to Betty saying no debate on religion, we might have a check-in on recent history and see if we can find any problems to fix. No need to look at the magic stuff because it's going great with the ban on debate. But our investigations would have revealed that there had been a strong push for some changes to the prayer book and abolition of the bishops to be replaced by some sort of democratic election thing. Yeah. Easy peasy for us. We just push that out to a commission of inquiry. We make sure that the muffins turn up for morning tea every day and they get an egg and lettuce sandwich for lunch. And that will just kill those issues over time. But none of that's relevant for Jim because he's just oblivious to it all. He's busy trying to show his top churchy types that he is smarter than they are. Okay, we might also find, well, we would find, there's a problem with churchy wages. These guys haven't had a pay rise in years and life's getting a bit hard. That's not necessarily bad for us. Too rich and they'll have too much time on their hands to think of more magical stuff. Too poor and they may rebel. Our guys are borderline too poor. And again, this is a great opportunity for you and me. Churchy types are busy right now supplementing their income by stuff like tending sheep. So here's a problem you and I can fix with a small pay rise, just a small one. And churchy types all over England will love us even more. As for the theological stuff, yeah, let's get half a dozen top churchy mates with some friendly nobles, form that committee, and anyone who wants stuff changed can work what they want into a document. We'll make it so they've got to have a couple of other churchy types sign off on it, along with the local bishop and the local lord, and you've just about killed it there. But then if it gets past that, then it can be submitted to our friendly council. They shouldn't get much in then, and we can have them meet once a year for, say, half a day, so that won't be enough time to make any decisions, and there you go. Problem solved. So Jim won't do any of that. He wants a nice theological debate so he can show off how intelligent he is. He also wants to dabble himself in churchy ritual. Now, there's two things there that should be avoided at all costs. He's a dick. About 100 Puritans will come in to see him. These guys have put together a well-written document looking for pretty minor changes. They want confirmation to go as a papist ritual, wearing of the surplice to be optional for magicians, and not so much music in the magic show. But the petition suggested a conference between Puritans and Anglicans, because we all know that you, Jim, have an inquiring and rather intelligent mind, and you love rational discourse. Oh, I sure do, says Jim, so yeah, great, we'll have this talk fest. What Jim has also totally missed was that Betty had given Puritans zero recognition, and that had worked. He's now recognised them and said they could argue against his very own royal bishops. Bishops see this as a challenge to their authority. The unis at Oxford had already condemned the petition as sedition. Well, did that come out well? They have condemned the petition as sedition, yeah, treason, and compared these guys to Presbyterians. Jim will try backpedalling after we get some unrest. Proclamation that will be issued to ban the presentation of petitions on religious stuff and saying the Anglican religion is totally in accord with the Gospels. We want conformity and any magician not doing the magic show correctly will be severely punished. Oh, well, that's calmed the Anglicans down. But they also want the conference shut down. Jim will say, look, calm down. I'm the top guy on religion, so I'll just deal with these guys. And hey, when these guys come at me and debate, it will mean the end of Puritanism in England and we can all live happily ever after. Now, what he's facing are the Puritan smartest and most zealous guys, so good luck, mate. Okay, let's bring it on. Day one. No Puritans allowed, so we're off to a bloody terrible start there, aren't we? King Jim will open up with religion is the soul of the kingdom and unity provides life to religion. Then he'll bang on and on for 5 hours to tell the guys that he's the smartest guy in the room. These Puritans will be awestruck when they hear me, and unlike previous kings, I see no reason to change this marvellous English religion. Day two, and in come 4 Puritans to chat against 9 top uni types, 8 deans, and the Lords of the Privy Chamber. They're totally outnumbered, and they can see this won't be going well for them. Forget awestruck. They just don't have the numbers. Okay, bring out your list of changes. It's not much compared to what Puritans have been asking for in the past, but still this is magic stuff, and King Jim will just be condescending. Rather than appearing wise or anything, he's just being insulting. If these be the greatest matters you be grieved with, I need not have been troubled with such importunities and complaints as been made unto me. Some other more private course might have been taken for your satisfaction. So, Jim's just trivialised this stuff that these guys see as important and have spent a lot of time thinking about. Puritans will change tack and start talking about ecclesiastical discipline, and the Anglican bishops will turn on them. Then it's on to a new translation of the magic book. Bishops will point out that there might be no inter-translations of it, and I'm with them. Translations aren't as easy as they sound. But Jim's onto this, saying he's never read a properly translated magic book, and of course, he will now see himself as the guy to do a proper job of that. Puritans will then score an own goal, suggesting the church should have a presbytery to make churchy decisions. We do not like the word presbytery. That's very much like the Scotty religion, and that Scotty religion just creates problems. That's enough for Jim, who can sum it all up. These Puritans need to conform or fuck off out of England. This whole exercise, then, has just made everything worse. Betty had kept it all together with vague definitions and no churchy debate and no threats like you can fuck off out of England, and Jim has just shot all that to bits. Closing ceremony, and our Anglican types will be full of praise for King Jim. He spoke with God's spirit, according to Archie Whitgift. Best king since baby Jesus is another one. At least one of those Anglicans, though, will privately write a bit more of an honest account. There was no inspiring our Puritans to the divining truth, just Jim getting up. Jim himself will write that the Puritans were all over the shop, and he's told them that if he'd presented this sort of stuff as uni students, they would have gotten a damn good flogging. Puritans will smartly be all humble and say, can we have some time to consider the conformity stuff? Jim thinks he's just completed stage one of his general Christian union in religion, but he's just made things worse. This Puritan thing is a bit vague, which is one of the big mistakes Jim made. A lot of our Anglican churchy types could be called Puritan, really, in that they want a bit more reform to the church. Some churchy types will now resign, given they can see Jim won't be listening to them. Under Betty, they at least saw a vague chance that reform might happen, even though it actually didn't. We can live in hope under Queen Betty, my dear listener, but no hope under Jim. Still, King Jim is fully on board with the idea of a new translation of the magic book, and to help out, he'll hire the best Greek and Hebrew scholars. We've had that Geneva Bible for years now, and you may not recall, so I shall remind you that it was the one where they wrote plenty of margin notes to help you understand whatever message the translators wanted you to understand. There was plenty of stuff that was anti-monarchy in those notes. These dicks didn't get that fundamental message of Paul Saul to obey the government. It's what makes a religion successful. For Jim, then, having one authorised magical book with no anti-king stuff in it would be great, thanks. Jim has well and truly leapt into action. Best and brightest from Oxford and Cambridge to do the job, then a review by the bishops, then they can give it to the Privy Council for a tick-off, and finally it can be authorised by royal consent. We're to work in teams with King Jim having his own team to do the psalms. One of his teammates will say, yeah, there wasn't much point being on a team with King Jim 1 and 6, because he was always right, while everyone else was always wrong. And once again, let's have a example of the bullshit in the magic book that was in use when I was a boy, which is this very one, King Jim. Here it is. Get rid of the word congregation, which is DIY religion, and replace it with church, which is organised religion. It seems extremely unlikely that baby Jesus would have approved of that. But religion has to suit the government. He also wants to try and make sense in some parts. Ecclesiastes 1.11 possibly says in English, lay thy bread upon wet faces. Lay thy bread upon wet faces. Yeah, my dear listener, I know. What's it all about? Well, Jim will have it changed to cast thy bread upon the waters. So maybe a bit more sense there. And I'll even give you the translation that is now in, what is it, the Good News Bible. Invest your money in foreign trade and one of these days you'll make a profit. Yeah, so it's hard with these words. And once again, we can see the word of God is whatever the guys in charge want it to be. Eventually, in 7 years, we may have the best attempt to translate the magic book into English. But it's a patchwork of taking what we see as the best of previous translations, then trying to make it readable, and we incorporate our current culture, of course, which means we want it written poetically as well, like if Shakespeare were to write it. Really, what God needs to do is come up with a new magic book to suit all languages and cultures in the 21st century. Jim will also be looking to reconcile with the Catholic thingy. Problem is, he wants the Pope to give up stuff. Who cares what stuff? Every attempt at getting the Catholics to give up stuff has failed. But Jim can make fine speeches. He's good at that, and our Anglicans are now comparing him to Constantine the Emperor, who will bring back the Council of Nicaea to unite all Christians. The Pope's got different ideas. His idea is that Jim should convert back to Catholicism. And Queen Anne isn't helping. She's fully Catholic by now and looking for a nice Catholic girl for Prince Henry Fred and trying to promote Catholics into top government jobs. Jim's also gone super soft on them with reports in the papers that Catholics are rather happy and Protestants are not happy. English Protestant judges will go hard on enforcing any anti-Catholic laws they can. Fuck those happy Catholics. The general population likewise will turn on the Catholics and we're getting into a bit of hatred of the buggers. Worse, Jim is being lenient to papists while being hard on Protestant Puritans. Time to get some numbers in. How many Catholics in England? Oh, fuck, that many? It's about 10,000. And while they might be peaceful and loyal, their churchy types may not be. In 1605, then, Jim worked out that the ungrateful population had failed to behave correctly in his policy of toleration. Yeah, it's not his policy that was wrong, it's naughty people. Time for a crackdown on Catholics, and that'll lead me back to the gunpowder plotters, which is where we can leave it, I think, this week. Yeah, just a little bit of Two Cellos there, channeling you two to get us into some historical fiction. And I am still with Christian Cameron and Sir William Gold. The fourth book, Sword of Justice. Marvellous stuff again. Plenty of Italian politics in there for me. Loved it. We'll end up with actually the wedding of Lionel. He was the second son of Baby Ted, wasn't he? Got married in Italy and then just died. But I can't wait to get into the next one because I think we're headed for Lionel was assassinated in this. So I'll be interested to see how Christian Cameron handles that. Marvellous read, Sword of Justice by Christian Cameron. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. What about the ever-reliable Beatles, but sung by Carla Azar with Tomorrow Never Knows. Hope to see you next week. Bye.